Hello and welcome to The Rest Is History, our latest bonus episode. Things have returned a little bit to normal at Rest Is History Towers because we've been home from the United States for just over a week. But Tom, no sooner had you returned from the US than you were off on your travels again because you have been on an extraordinary coast-to-coast voyage, haven't you? No, voyage is the wrong word. It's a trudge.
A road trip from sea to shining sea, Dominic. So I can't remember if I mentioned doing this before. I have a very good friend, Jamie Muir, son of Frank Muir, who British people of a certain age will remember as a doyen of, he was on, what was it? Call My Bluff. It was a kind of panel show and yeah. He advertised fruit and nut. Anyway, this is all by way of...
A panel show humorist, I think it's fair to say.
He was much, much sharper witty than that. But Jamie is the father of Anna, who is my elder daughter Katie's oldest friend. So they've kind of grown up.
Yeah.
He's a very, very good friend. And he turned 70 and I promised him as his birthday present, because he loves kind of deep dives into English history, that we would do this thing where we drew a line from two places that I'd never been to and wanted to see, Sutton Hoo and Blackpool. And we would basically go, we'd follow that line and we would see what lay on the line and kind of visit it. And the aim was to have as varied a selection of places to visit as we possibly could. And Dominic, I'm happy to report that England has a very TARDIS-like quality.
Yeah.
It feels small, but when you go in deep, basically there's kind of infinite fascination.
So talk me through. You'd never been to Sutton Hoo.
I'd never been to Sutton Hoo.
That's extraordinary.
And it's really weird because I've actually stayed quite a lot on the Suffolk coast. I stayed on Shingle Street, which is down there.
Yeah.
But I'd never been to Sutton Hoo. I think it's because every time I'd been to Shingle Street, it had always been shut. I went and it would be closed. And Sutton Hoo, I thought, was the least impressive, the most disappointing thing that I saw.
Oh my word.
I thought it was really, well, it's been National Trusted. So it's all kind of visitor centres and, you know, Radwell burgers and all that kind of stuff.
Brilliant. Love all that. Love the gift shop.
And basically the burial site looks like a golf course.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot to see, really.
Yeah.
So much more powerful is the neighbouring village of Rendlesham, which according to Bede was the site of a kind of great royal centre where Radwald, who is the king, supposed to have been laid to rest in the ship burial at Sutton Hoo. That's supposed to be where he had his palace. Well, Bede tells us that. And nobody knew where it was. And then it got discovered by illegal metal detectorists, Nighthawks they're called, who were digging up a field and finding all kinds of Saxon treasures. And so they fenced the fields off and brought in legitimate metal detectorists, and they scanned it for basically 3 years. And the products of that are in a museum at Sutton Hoo, which is actually very good. I mean, full of quite Roman coins, little medallions, all that kind of stuff. So very interesting. But for anyone who's seen the detectorists, the field, there's a kind of field in one of the series with a great oak in it, which plays a key part in the plot. And I think that it was that field, or maybe it was that field that inspired it, because it's a very, very eerie place. It's an isolated church, this beautiful field where this palace stood. The church is meant to have stood on a much earlier church, which in turn is meant to have stood on a temple where the ship is meant to have been taken up to Sutton Hoo. So very deep kind of earth magic. But what makes Rendlesham even better, Dominic, is that this is the location of Britain's Roswell.
I know, UFOs. So 1980, that was.
1980, December 1980.
It's very close to RAF Woodbridge, which is probably the explanation. But people saw lights, didn't they? Fireballs and stuff.
Well, back then it was a US base.
Yeah, yeah.
And so have you been there?
I haven't.
Well, I can highly recommend it because there is now a woodland trail.
Love a woodland trail.
So you start off with the US base.
Yeah.
And then you go off and you go to the place where they first spotted a flying saucer, and then another one, and then another one. And in the very depths of the wood, just... There's a surprise waiting for you in the wood, which I won't spoil it for anyone who wants to go and do that. So we did that, and then we cut across, and we came to Woolpit, which is where, in the reign of King Stephen, two green children appeared from a cave and only ate beans. So that was exciting.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah, we crossed the fens and the site where Charles I wanted to build a great palace.
Did he?
He was opposed by Oliver Cromwell in his role as a NIMBY local MP.
Very good.
And nothing ever got built. Grantham, great. We stopped in Grantham.
The Margaret Thatcher Memorial Town.
Yes, so there's a statue of her and there's a plaque on where she grew up.
Oh, did you go to the grocery shop?
Yeah.
Oh, very exciting.
Yeah. It's a chemist now.
Yeah.
But there's the inn in Grantham. Have you heard of this?
No.
That's brilliant. Supposedly built in 1209.
Yeah.
There's a great gateway with heads of Edward III and Philippa of Hainaut, because he stayed there.
Yeah.
You have breakfast in a room where Richard III demanded the Great Seal so that he could condemn the Duke of Buckingham to death. Charles I and Cromwell, again, both stayed there. George IV stayed there. Edward VII stayed there.
These claims are made of all inns, Tom.
No, they really did.
Between Sutton Hoo and Blackpool. Okay,
No, they really did. Okay. Because I was sceptical. And then I checked that they were all legitimate. So that is fantastic.
In the 1970s, The Sun described Grantham as the most boring town in Britain.
The Sun is wrong. I suggest that they go and stay in this medieval hotel.
Okay. It's brilliant. Where did you go after Grantham?
We went to Southwold, which has Southwold Minster with beautiful leaves fashioned out of stone in the chapter house. We went to Derbyshire, where we looked at some standing stones. You would have enjoyed that. We went into some caves where Byron fired his pistols. We went to the Brutalist bus stop in Burnley. And then we ended up in Blackpool, which I absolutely loved. You were being very rude about it. I thought it was brilliant. I mean, apart from the slight smell of poo.
Right.
Because there'd been a big sewage leak. So that was admittedly.
That's nice.
But it was gorgeous weather and not a cloud in the sky. And I imagine, I'm told that this is typical for the Lancashire Riviera, that it never rains there.
Tom, I've been to Blackpool, I think, 3 times filming, and it rained every single time and was incredibly dreary and Eastern European in Atmos.
Well, so the sun sank in a great blaze of Turner-esque colour and kind of turned the seas to a molten copper. It was glorious.
Crikey, this is very poetic.
Oh, it was wonderful. And then we stayed in the Imperial Hotel, where you'll know all the Prime Minister stayed.
Yeah.
So in the bar, they have a signed photo of Tony Blair and Stanley Baldwin.
Not together, presumably.
No, they were on the wall together.
Not in the same photo, though.
Not in the same photo, no. I thought it'd be quite a good place for an Athelstan's meeting,
did
actually.
You? I filmed in the ballroom about the Labour Party conference in the early 1980s, the 1981 Labour Party conference, or 1980, I can't remember which. There was no plaque of me having been there.
No, there wasn't.
Shocking.
Did you go to the Pleasure Beach?
Is that on the pier? No, by the pier.
No. It's by a pier, but it's the oldest kind of pleasure resort in pleasure ground, fairground in Britain. So that is properly historic. So they have the oldest fairground ride, certainly in Europe, I mean, maybe in the world, which was built by, what's his name, Maxim, who developed the machine gun.
Oh, wow, crikey.
And he was very interested in space, very influenced by Jules Verne. And so he designed this ride with space rockets. And it's basically the standard ride where, you know, that they hang and then it goes up and gravity forces the things up that you ride in. But it was built in 1904 and he was born in 1840. So to go on a funfair ride designed by a guy built in 1840 was quite something.
That's impressive.
And also they have the earliest ghost train, which I think was built in 1930.
No, I do like a ghost train.
It's haunted by someone called, a ghost called Cloggy, who was a fairground worker and is called Cloggy because all you hear is the ringing of his clogs.
There was an excellent ghost train at the West Midlands Safari and Leisure Park in Bewdley, the home of Stanley Baldwin, Tom, where I used to go on school trips. Oh, must be 1970s.
Parvenu.
Yeah,
Parvenu.
Exactly.
If you want to 1930, when you've got to go to Blackpool. And that's what I loved about it. It's a properly historic place.
Okay.
And I'd never thought of it as being historic. It's wonderful.
Tom, everywhere's historic when you think about it. You know?
Well, yes, including Burnley bus station.
So, Claire H., a very quick question for you. Of all the British national trails, she says, which is the most fun and the most interesting?
I think Hadrian's Wall.
Not the most fun, though. It's not the most fun.
Yeah, absolutely the most fun. Because there's non-stop Roman stuff along it.
No, the most fun is walk along to the kind of southwest coastal path. That's very nice. Have you done that?
Yeah, but it's artificial. I like a trail that is there for a reason. So Offa's Dyke would be another example. But all these slightly fabricated ones.
Tom likes trudging through featureless landscapes, featureless fields.
I like trails that are there for a reason and that give you things to see.
All right.
And as you all know, Dominic, I made my children, when they were very young, walk Hadrian's Wall, and they loved it. And I have a photograph of them enjoying it in the Newcastle rain to prove it, which I might put on the Discord when this goes out so that people can see just how much they were enjoying
it.
Yeah,
that's very funny. That's very funny. Actually, the person who doesn't get as much attention as she deserves in that photo is your wife, Sadie, who's standing in the background. She looks utterly weary and fed up.
Yeah, well, the brilliant thing about Sadie is I've made her do it twice.
Oh, God.
The first year that we went out together, I made her do it.
Crikey.
I made her cry.
That was a test.
I know. Can I just mention one other thing I've done?
It's about cricket.
Yes. And you don't have to understand cricket to know this. I'm a bowler. Bowlers get wickets. By midsummer, I should have got 15 wickets. So far, I had got zero, silch, none, yeah, nada. None.
Nothing.
And it was a two innings match on Sunday. We're playing at Avebury. So it's our solstice fixture. First innings, no wickets. Second innings, four wickets, Dominic. Four wickets, a match-winning performance.
Yeah. Was this one against children or was it against adults?
No, they were properly good batsmen.
Right.
So well a done. Great achievement. Well done. And basically nothing has made me feel happier this year than that.
Oh, that's good.
I've been going around. I wake up in the middle of the night feeling happy. And for a fraction of a second, I can't remember why. And then I remember and I just punch the air.
Were you not made happy when you saw yourself in the newspaper on Sunday being described as, and I quote, a totemic dork?
No.
And a man who would wear a codpiece for clicks?
No. I didn't mind that, but being described as a totemic dork, I didn't know what Josh Glancy, who wrote the piece, was going on about there. I'm obviously not a dork.
No, obviously not. Obviously not. So this is a reference to We Were in the Sunday Times, which was very nice. Now, there was some dispute, wasn't there, beforehand, because the Sunday Times wanted us to dress up in historical costumes.
Yes.
And in fact,
I was on for that.
Plans had been laid for you to dress as, genuinely for you to dress as Anne Boleyn.
I was all up for that.
And I stamped on it and said...
Well, hilariously, you said, I don't think we should do this because people won't take us seriously, which I thought was very sweet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, implying that they already do.
Exactly. I felt that the authoritative and sober and serious
because I think what Josh actually said was he was comparing us and he was saying one of these two will wear a codpiece for clicks and one won't.
Yeah.
And I was the one who would and you were the one who wouldn't.
Well, I wouldn't. I mean, I didn't and never will.
So what they did very amusingly was because they didn't have us actually in costumes, they did cartoons of us.
They did, yeah.
So there's one of you as Henry VIII, me as Anne Boleyn,
yeah.
You as Napoleon, me as Duke Wellington, me as Gandalf, you as Frodo.
Yeah, that was funny. It was well done.
It was a great piece, and we're very grateful to Josh for doing it, bless him, and also to Martin Hemmings, who's the editor of the Sunday Times magazine. Bless them both.
Well, Tom, we have some thanks for you. So from the son of a friend of the show. So I'm just going to read you this message. I thought you might like to know that my father, Peter Green, greatly appreciated your kind comments about the year of Salamis in your book, Persian Fire. He's now 98 and still strong, working on a major book on, Tom, Herodotus. And that's from Tim Green, now in Cologne,
bless
Germany.
Him.
And so his father, Peter Green, not just the author of The Year of Salamis, but the author of From Alexander to Actium, which we have both pointed to as one of the great, I mean, genuinely enormous. I mean, you need a wheelbarrow to transport one of the great history books.
So when I did my top five history books that had had the most influence on me, which we did as a live show, didn't we? About two or three months ago.
Yeah.
And I nominated From Alexander to Actium as one of the five books that had had the most influence on me. It was basically the book that made me want to write ancient history. So I owe Peter Green an enormous debt. He's absolutely wonderful writer, and it's brilliant to know that he's still going strong.
Still writing at 98.
Obviously,
Tom.
Look forward to his book on Herodotus very much.
Fantastic. Fantastic stuff. All right. So we've spent too much time wittering about fields in Suffolk or whatever.
No, we've had important issues like my wickets.
So, Tom, do you want to pick a question from the Discord from the Wangs? Do you want to go with Davey E's question? I don't know.
Davey, yes. So this is one for you, Dominic. But as we see yet more political convulsions caused by internal divisions within the Conservative Party, that's here in Britain, what are the most significant previous internal wranglings within the Tories in history that have led to some key historical moments? So that is a massive question.
It's a massive question. You could do them all as podcasts, actually. So just give you three or four. There is the argument about the repeal of the Corn Laws. So that is the adoption of basically a free trade, the repeal of protectionists. Laws that were designed to protect the interests of the landowning classes. So that's a rift between Robert Peel and Benjamin Disraeli, I guess you'd say very, very simplistically. So that's in the sort of mid-19th century. You have the argument about tariff reform. So it's again, it's protectionism. At the beginning of the 20th century, it sounds so dull, but actually it's a massive issue. It's really interesting. Joseph Chamberlain, who had already split the Liberals, then left the Liberals, effectively allied with the Conservatives, then split the Conservatives at the beginning of the 20th century. The party was often quite divided in the 20s and 30s, the era of Stanley Baldwin, about India. So Churchill ended up in the wilderness because of his what was seen as his very reactionary take on India. All through the Thatcher years, tensions between what were called wets and dries, so people who were kind of true blue Thatcherites, the kind of roundheads, and then the kind of the old cavaliers,
the wets,
sort of the patrician wets, as they were called, arguments about Europe in the 1990s, and, you know, Brexit in the 2010s. So actually, Tory factionalism is nothing new.
Well, but it's inevitable, isn't it? And it's as in a lot of countries with, I suppose, an electoral framework that doesn't give rise to coalitions. So it'd be the same with America.
Yeah.
Where you have two main parties, by definition, they're going to be coalitions, which they're endlessly fighting.
Although I think actually, I agree with you, and it's exactly the same Labour, by the way. I mean, we could easily do lots of podcasts on Labour splits. You know, the Labour splits are often very intense, but the Tories, I would say, tend to be a tiny bit more factional court politics than the Labour, slightly more ideologically charged.
Although the Tories have been very ideological over Europe.
They have, agreed. But I think those splits are much greater than anything you see in the American parties, actually.
Although at the moment, maybe, I mean...
In where? In the Republican Party? You mean?
I think so. I think, I mean, between the kind of the old school traditional Republicans and all the MAGAs.
I think there's something about, maybe because of the smallness of Britain comparative to America.
But the sense I get of the Republicans at the moment, and American listeners will obviously, I don't even know why I'm talking about it when we call I really am not qualified to pontificate on it. But I do get the sense that the rival wings of the Republican Party at the moment really detest each other in a way that wasn't the case previously, to the extent that quite a few people on the, I don't think the left of the Republican Party is the right way of putting it, let's say the more traditionalist, the less populist wing of the Republican Party.
The Mitt Romney wing, I suppose.
Yeah, David Frum, those kind of people.
Yeah,
are so hostile, say, to Trumpism that they refuse to countenance voting for him.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
That does seem something new.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. The sense that the rejection of a former party elite, basically by a lot of the grassroots. Anyway, listen, this is a fascinating subject in and of itself, and we could go deeper into it, and I think into the history, which would be interesting. But we don't have time because, Tom, I have to ask you King's Thursday's question. Now that you've seen the fossil hall at the Smithsonian Natural History Museum in Washington D.C. and the Titanosaur in London, which did you enjoy more, and how do they compare with the Bernissart iguanodons in Brussels, which are my favourite of the three, so much so that I saw them on my honeymoon? That's from Susan.
What a wonderful honeymoon. Lucky Susan.
Well, at least it wasn't Hadrian's Wall, Tom.
Well, so the Titanosaur in London is a temporary show. So it's not part of the history of that very ancient natural history museum. It's the first great natural history museum built. The Smithsonian has wonderful specimens, but again, it's, I think the displays are quite modern. When I saw the iguanodons in Brussels, it was quite a kind of old school display, reflecting the fact that they were very early finds. And I like that link between dinosaurs and, you know, the history of their discovery in the 19th century.
Yeah.
So I like the Natural History Museum, the traditional display of the Diplodocus in the Great Hall. I like the display in the Peabody Museum at Yale, which is a kind of wonderful museum. So of those three, I think I would go with Brussels. I think I'd agree with Susan. But just to give a shout out to what I think is the best, not just the best paleontology museum I've ever been to, but the best museum, full stop. It is my dream museum. And it's the Royal Tyrrell in Drumheller in Alberta, Canada.
Oh,
it is fantastic. It's situated on basically a kind of great fossil vein where you just have to walk and you see bones sticking out of the rock. They have so much great stuff. They have three tyrannosaurs and one of them is exquisitely beautiful. It's kind of, the bones are black and it's in a kind of death arch and they've kept it, the skeleton embedded within the rock. It's one of the most stunning things I've ever seen. Another completely stunning thing. In fact, the most, probably the single most overwhelming, overpowering object I've ever seen in any museum is a great slab of rock that looks like a Rothko. So great streaks of color. And scored across the middle is a kind of yellowish line. And that line is the iridium left by the asteroid that hit planet Earth and wiped out all the non-avian dinosaurs, all the dinosaurs that weren't birds. So it has the beauty of a Rothko, but it has death you know, hardwired into its fabric. It has, the museum has a dinosaur feather in amber. It has stuff from the Burgess Shale, so very kind of pre-Cambrian. It's amazing, amazing museum. Can't recommend it highly enough. And Dominic, what's even better is that in the gulches that separate, basically the town is built around a kind of river valley. In the gulches along that river valley, they filmed Unforgiven, the Clint Eastwood film.
Oh, really?
And on the opposite side, they have a massive replica of first century AD Jerusalem. Drumheller, as well as hosting the world's best paleontology museum, also hosts Canada's largest passion play. So it's an amazing place.
We should give Canada a bit more love in the podcast, Tom. So yeah, we often get comments from Canadian listeners saying, where's Canadian history?
Well, actually, I met a Canadian yesterday and he was complaining. And I promised we would do better.
You'd do better. Well, you know I want to do the taking of Quebec.
Yeah, let's do that.
General Wolfe. Okay, so Katie Magdalene. Radio 4 recently had as book of the week, The West by Neisha McSweeney. The premise is challenging the idea that there's such a thing as a Western intellectual and cultural tradition rooted in the classical and Christian past. She starts, shockingly, with Herodotus. Do Tom and Dominic have any thoughts on this question? Tom, I imagine you will have thoughts.
But I haven't heard it, so I don't know. I don't know what she said.
Do you think there is such a thing as the West?
I don't want to comment on...
Don't comment on the book. You know. Put the book to one side. Imagine the question was, is there such a thing as a Western cultural and intellectual tradition?
Well, I think the West is convenient shorthand for the heirs of what was in the Middle Ages called Christendom. So in other words, the Latin-speaking half of the Roman Empire, ultimately.
Yeah.
And the key determinant is the form of Christianity that was practiced in those lands. So Protestantism would be embraced in that, and the countries that were settled by people from those lands. So that would include the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. We can't use the word Christendom anymore because it's not Christian in that sense. But I think that the West is a convenient shorthand for that cultural tradition, which I absolutely see as being, yeah, of course. I mean, it's indisputably, it seems to me, a hard cultural tradition. Probably the world's most influential cultural tradition.
I agree. Of course, it's never been hermetically sealed off, has it, from other influences? I mean, we did that,
episode
with Ali Ansari about Persia, and there's all kinds of other influences. But there's definitely the case that people through history have thought there was such a tradition. And in a way, to go back and sort of to debunk it, while maybe satisfying, misses the point that the very fact that people thought it existed and thought it mattered means that it, in a way, it did come to exist and to matter.
Well, Dominic,
thought, a bit like the literary canon. Go on, Tom.
You know what I'm going to say. I think the ambition to dissolve the distinctiveness of the West into a kind of universal identity.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that's what is being argued in this book. So I don't know if that's the argument. But the great foundational conceit of the Catholic Church was that it was universal. That's what Catholic means. And Protestants inherited that conceit no less than Catholics did. And they exported it when they went around the world. And because Western political, economic, technological, cultural, moral, ethical influence has been properly global in its sweep, and because its ideals and aspirations have always been couched in universal terms, so it has been very, very easy for people from the West to conflate the West with the global. And that can provide sustenance for those on the right who see Western superiority as essentially being so great that it's become a universal global culture. And it's also there on the left where the claims of Western distinctiveness get dissolved into a kind of universal construct, but that the impulse to do that is itself Western. So that would be my answer.
I did think you were going to say that, to be honest.
Yeah, I did. I mean, you know, it's nothing.
Okay. Is Githan, who would you nominate as the first president of the British Republic?
I think you'd be very good at that, actually.
Oh, thanks, Tom.
You go around making friends and influencing people, being rude to President Macron. And
yeah, right. I would, first of all, look for the dynasty that worked so well last time. So see if there's any descendants of the Cromwell family knocking around. Richard Cromwell doesn't get the love
That would be good for relations with Ireland, wouldn't it?
Well, you know, I think...
Bygones be bygones.
Yeah. I still sometimes get grief from people about my views on Cromwell's robustness. I mean, they're not going to win, so I don't know why they continue moaning about it. Who would I nominate? I'll tell you who would win. The king would win. The New Statesman once had an excellent editorial about this. Somebody in the New Statesman said...
But would you nominate him?
Oh, I'd nominate him, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it would be very satisfying.
You know who I'd nominate? I would nominate Prince Edward. And I wouldn't rest content with him being president for long. He would become king.
Of course. You'd do a Napoleon III with him, right? He would become president.
Yeah.
And then emperor or something.
No, he wouldn't be emperor. He'd be king.
Well, you could be emperor of Britain, like Athelstan.
Yeah, King Arthur.
So King Simeon II of Bulgaria, who was exiled from Bulgaria just after World War II, I think, as a very little boy. He became prime minister of Bulgaria in the 1990s, bizarrely, but never seized power. Where would Bulgaria be today, Tom, if only he had?
Where indeed. I mean, the thing is that anyone in a position to become president in Britain is so hated that they could never serve as a unifying figure.
But like in America, I mean, that this is the difference between when you've got a head of state who is also a head of government, it's a very difficult thing to play both parts. I mean, you know, when John F. Kennedy, when we do our Kennedy podcast in November, when he goes to Dallas on the 22nd of November, 1963, he is nervous and anxious because he and his wife think that people will spit at them in the street. Mm. They are actually shocked. And actually one of the last sentences he ever heard was the governor of Texas's wife, Nellie Connolly, saying to him, "You can't say Dallas doesn't love you, Mr. President," because actually the reaction from the crowds is much warmer than he is expecting. Yeah. I mean, the fact that a head of state can visit a city worried that people are going to throw stuff at them and despise them, that's an inevitable result of a society where you combine the two roles, which in most societies, let's say Ireland, for example, are detached from one another.
I mean, I wonder, though, whether people in Britain just hate each other more.
We're very irreverent towards our politicians, and we have a very
quite irreverent towards even members of the royal family.
I mean, you know who would have been president of the British Republic in the last 5 to 10 years? Who would have eventually won in the final round of an election? There's no getting away from it. Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
And then there'd be no getting rid of him.
But no, I mean, imagine what would be happening right now.
Anyway.
Tom, let's do one more question. I know we have to go because Theo has to go on holiday. Theo, who works, I have to say, there was an article in the Sunday Times about us, but what it actually should have mentioned is the team, because Theo toils like he works like a dog, basically, and also has to manage...
Or like a hero, Dominic.
Yeah, he has to manage the massive egos of the presenters, which is no
easy... Well, the massive ego of one of the presenters,
which is
one of us, what? Is modest, retiring.
Is that the guy who talks about his cricket wickets? The fact that he took 4 wickets in a...
Yeah, but that's an amazing achievement. 4 wickets. I mean, come on.
right. An amazing achievement.
Even the most modest person would be blowing his trumpet over that.
He says
four
of himself.
4 wickets, Dominic.
Let's do this last question.
Yeah.
It's from WDC. And you see, this is a test of your modesty. If there is one day a live show in Scandinavia and I get the chance and I ask really nicely, will Tom sign my 1995 paperback copy of The Vampire? And would it be the only existing signed 1995 paperback copy? So this is your novel about Lord Byron.
As a vampire.
As a vampire.
And we will be obviously returning to Lord Byron next January, Dominic, to mark the 200th anniversary of his death. Or did he die?
Right.
Because the thesis in The Vampire is that he's still around.
Okay.
Well, yes, of course. Of course I would, WDC. I absolutely would sign your paperback copy of The Vampire. And yes, it probably would be the only existing signed 1995.
A live show in Scandinavia. Where would we do it, Tom? Where would you like to do a live show in Scandinavia? At the Yelling Runestone?
Yelling Museum would be brilliant.
Harold Bluetooth became the first Christian king of Denmark.
Yeah, that'd be great.
At the Roskilde Ship Museum.
I think Copenhagen or...
Yeah.
We're both fixing on Danish locations and we might be insulting our Swedish and Norwegian.
I like Sweden. You know I like Sweden. I've never been to Norway.
Norway's great. I mean, it's as beautiful as everyone says.
All right. We have a live stream coming up, which I will just remind you of. The live stream is on the evening of Monday, the 26th of June. We have two episodes about the life of J. Robert Oppenheimer, father of the nuclear bomb, and then martyr, or was he, in the sort of communist, anti-communist witch hunts of the 1950s.
So we quite a kind of Oscar Wilde-esque story.
Slightly, with a slightly. Kind of trial. Yeah, with a trial, slightly. With a sort of set-piece yep. trial. And then we have our two episodes about the adventures of Indiana Jones, in particular the Ark of the Covenant and the Holy Grail. So really delving into the kind of biblical and medieval mysteries of these two things.
What were they? Did they exist? All that kind of thing.
And then soon enough, we will be on the American Revolution. So loads of fun things. And we'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.